I'm Dr. Leif Tapanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Hey, our guests today are Davis and Haley Gove. They are owners and brewers of Gin Dandy Brewing in Pocatello. Peter, it's morning, and I'm thinking about beer. How about you?
I think I go to bed thinking about beer, and then I wake up and I'm wondering.
Thinking about beer?
Yeah. I had bran flakes for breakfast this morning, and I was wondering if it would taste good with a Scottish ale or something like that in there.
Very forward of you. I was thinking stouts this morning.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Your call. Your call. You know, we're going to talk about beer and Idaho and the beer industry, and it's kind of booming business now.
I think people will be surprised that just how involved Idaho is with brewing.
Well, it's wonderful. We're going to get into that and a whole lot more after Nature News. Peter?
Right on. Leif, you know, bloodworms are a type of bristleworms, and they're typically found in shallow marine waters, and they can grow up to about 14 inches, a little over a foot. And they're primarily used as fish food or bait. They're also very disagreeable, aggressive, easily provoked, and venomous to boot.
You're so, winning me over.
Oh, totally. Right, and they're red because their skin is translucent and you can see the hemoglobin inside of them. They're an ucky critter.
A foot long.
Yeah.
Bloodworm. All right.
Today we're going to talk about their four copper teeth.
Copper teeth.
Yes. Their teeth are used for biting prey and rivals because, again, they're very disagreeable. And the crazy thing is their teeth and jaws are composed of 10% copper and are so hardy they will last the entire 5-year average lifespan of a bloodworm. Our teeth wear down. Every animal that you know of, their teeth wear down. But these guys don't.
Copper teeth.
Copper teeth, yes. Researchers at UC Santa Barbara have discovered how the bloodworms form their copper teeth. And they use a multitasking protein that is mostly glycine and histidine. Now, follow this closely. The protein helps recruit copper ions, causes the mixture produced to separate like oil and water, catalyzes the formation of the pigment melanin, and assists in its polymerization and integrates both the melanin and itself into films and fibers, forming bridges between molecules using copper. And these multitasking proteins are the third known method for animals to form hydrogels alongside with vertebrates that create cartilage, and squids and octopuses use to form their beaks.
So I'm trying to picture our 14-inch bloodworm and its teeth, what those even look like. Are these big teeth?
So I had to Google them, and their copper teeth look like metal-type fish hooks. They don't really have a barb on the end,
right?
But they look like fish hooks. They're not the copper color, which would have been kind of cool.
Sure.
And, you know, over
here. Well, you said melanin, so I'm thinking they're dark in color.
Yep. Okay. They're kind of a black color. But wouldn't it be nice if they would have oxidized and turned bright blue?
That's pretty fun. Okay, so in order to find one of these, if you wanted to find a bloodworm, you have to be in a shallow marine environment, you said?
Yeah, it's kind of in tidal pools. Or if you go to your local pet store, you can get a package of frozen ones to feed to your fish. Thaw one out, throw them under a microscope, and marvel at the wonder of their copper teeth.
Enjoy the copper teeth. I love it. That's fantastic. Well, that was a total surprise to me. Thanks.
Yeah, it was to me too.
Well, it's trivia time. Today's topic, of course, is beer. So this is a beer-related question. Idaho produces around 55 million bushels of barley per year. And 75% of that goes to produce beer. So our question is, how many 12-ounce beers does that produce? Get out your calculators. When we come back from the break, Davis and Haley Gove join us to talk about beer.
Hi, I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Here at NPR, we try to reach all kinds of listeners.
My name is Leo, and I'm 8 years old.
And we take feedback very seriously.
I never hear much about nature or dinosaurs or things like that.
So when Leo wrote us about our appalling lack of dinosaur coverage on All Things Considered, we knew we had to talk to him. Hi, Leo.
Hi.
I hear from your parents that you want to be a paleontologist when you grow up, and now we've got one on the line for you.
Okay.
Let me let you ask a question.
How did dinosaurs grow to be so big?
This is hard-hitting journalism because these are the types of questions that keep paleontologists up at night.
In public radio, we value our relationship with each and every one of our listeners. You listen to us, and we listen to you too. So keep our connection strong. Donate to this station right now. Here's how.
You know who covers dinosaurs really well? The Nature of Idaho on KISU. Support NPR and KISU programs by visiting KISU.org and click donate.
Hey, welcome back from the break. I want to welcome our guests today, Davis and Haley Gove. They're the owners and brewers at Jim Dandy Brewing here in Pocatello. So first off, thank you for joining us today on The Nature of Idaho.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
We're excited
to be here.
We're so excited.
Well, wonderful. Can you tell us a little bit about yourselves, and then maybe we'll get into how you got into brewing?
Yeah, so my name's Davis. My wife and I both own Jim Dandy Brewing, and we are actually born and raised here in Pocatello. Spent a little time away, kind of on sabbatical of sorts, I guess, trying to learn more about brewing and working in the brewing industry up in the Pacific Northwest. We decided to come back here to start a brewery, knowing that we're right here in the middle of barley country. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm Haley. I am one of the owners and brewers at Jim Dandy Brewing. My background is mostly in microbiology. I got a degree here at Idaho State and chemistry, but I did work as a microbiologist in Bozeman, Montana. So that's the majority of my background. Was a home brewer for many years, enjoyed it. And Davis and I did that together. And yeah, just love brewing beer, worked at lots of different breweries, and we're able to hone in on all of our production brewery skills.
Yeah, our production skills.
So that's awesome. You know, that microbiology background probably had to come in a little bit
handy. It did. It was very handy, actually. We actually started as home brewers, and when home brewing's fun. You can go anywhere from, extract kits all the way up to all grain. But we kind of started extract when we were way, way young.
Yeah, probably
we'll
about
say 21.
Yeah. I'd say 20. I think it was your 22nd birthday that I bought you that first extract homebrew kit. We brewed a brown.
Yep. And then we graduated, I guess you could say, up to the all grain. Had our own mill, had really nice fermenters, still at the home brewing scale. So learning that and then also working as a microbiologist and having all of the yeast knowledge and how to take care of yeast and what is spoiling bacteria and how to keep a brewery clean, which is one of the most important things about brewing beer is cleanliness. That all really helped with making a production brewery.
So how long did it take for you? How many extract kits did you run through before you decided to take the next step?
I think we only did two extract kits before. When we get into something, we get really into it. So we did a couple of them. It's really simple and easy process to do if you're just doing an extract kit. But if you're really into the beer, you want more.
Yeah, so, and the process of actually brewing the beer.
Yeah, for sure. So we're starting to work with actual barley, malted wheat, different types of ingredients like that really piqued our interest so we could fine-tune everything to the finest level and really make large impacts in the beer through tiny differences.
Okay, can we start from the ground up? What are the basic ingredients that every beer needs to have in it?
Yeah, so the number one ingredient, which gets looked over, is just water. The majority of a beer is water. That has a lot of impact in the beer, especially when you look at different mineral contents and salt contents in the water. So when we're brewing a beer, we'll actually start with a base level, very low constituent content in the water and build up to create a different water profile for every beer that we do. That's number one. The next is barley. And right here in Pocatello, Idaho, we're basically in the barley basket of America is what I like to refer to it as. That's where we get all of our sugar from the beer. If you took just barley by itself right out of the field, you wouldn't actually extract any fermentable sugar. It needs to be malted first. So after they grow the barley, it goes to a malt house. There's quite a few of them here in Southeast Idaho. And they turn it into a type of sugar and get the correct enzymes that the yeast will then use to make fermentable sugar and ferment that into alcohol. The next thing is hops.
Mm-hmm. So hops are a really important part of not only offering beer stability, but also a lot of flavor. Hops have become extremely popular within the past 6 or 7 years, I would say. And now there's a lot of different types of aroma hops. A lot of hops used to just be used for bittering properties, where you add the hops to the boil. And sometimes now you don't even add hops to a boil. You'll just add it post a boil, or you'll add it during the whirlpool just to get the aroma properties. So you can get a lot of flavor out of hops. A lot of beers that we make, especially, people are like, did you put fruit in this? It tastes like there's oranges or the grapefruit. And that typically all comes from hops. Yeah. So hops are a really interesting part of a beer.
Yeah, and then the last ingredient is yeast. And yeast isn't so much of an ingredient to the beer, but you couldn't create the beer without the yeast. All the yeast comes out of the beer by the time that you're drinking it. But the yeast takes all of that sugar and turns it into alcohol and CO2, which is where the carbonation comes from.
So it's complicated, but there's really 4 components, right? If I counted right,
yeah,
there's 4 fundamental components, but there's so many little variations that come into play. Where did you start when you started producing at the scale you are now at the brewery? What was the first kind of beer that you started making?
Yeah, actually, our first beer was the Dark Sky Porter, which we'll bring back out of the old playbook sometimes. And the reason why we created that one was because the water profile here really works well with dark beers. It's got a good bit of hardness. It's actually close to the same mineral content in calcium as Dublin. So that's one reason why when you look at these different areas in the world, they make a type of beer. A lot of the times because of the water that they're using.
I've never thought of it that way. That's really fascinating. And so, yeah, I think of Pocatello's water as being the hardest water
it
I've
is.
Ever encountered.
Yes,
yeah,
and
that can be
hard.
A benefit, right, to it, certain types
it can.
Of beer.
It can, yeah. So depending on how they treat the water, that different constituents there, that's not necessarily great for yeast health. But in terms of calcium, magnesium, calcium sulfate, different constituents that you want to give to your yeast for the yeast health, you have to kind of balance that. So hard water is great, but there's only really one type of beer you can make with it. So that's why we actually don't use city water, just because we make so many different types of beers. So that way we can make sure that that beer is always the same too.
Yeah, so. We use city water, but we just strip it down.
Correct,
to,
yes.
With a serious filtration process,
yeah.
So that we take almost all of the hardness out when we're trying to brew like a light beer.
So a lager, pilsner,
lagers, pilsners,
blondes.
For example. Yeah, if you look at the city of Pilsen in the Czech Republic, it is basically RO water. That's how soft their water is. So they make
extremely,
they can actually make really great light-colored beers. So that mineral constituency has a really big effect on the pH of the beer, which can make the beer drink a lot better if it's lighter water and lighter color. So,
yeah, and I find the water quality interesting because I go back to pre-prohibition where you had every state had multiple little breweries.
Yeah.
And, you know, they could be brewing, say, a lager in Minnesota versus a lager in Washington.
Yeah.
And it would have a different flavor because of the water quality.
Yes, water is probably, they're all very important aspects, but I feel like water, in my opinion, is one of the most important aspects to making good, consistent beer. You have to make sure that your water is exactly how you want it every time, because if it's not, it might produce a great beer, but it might not be a
exactly
consistent
what
beer.
You want as well. Yeah.
So you spoke about barley, and Idaho is a center for barley production. Can you tell us a little bit about local ingredients and what's available to you?
For sure. Being based here in Pocatello, the most local ingredient that we're going to see is barley. If you drive just north into the Snake River Plain, a very large percentage of those fields are producing malting barley. A lot of that is going to go to Budweiser. There's a Budweiser malting plant up in Idaho Falls. There's a Modelo malting plant up in Idaho Falls. Right here in Pocatello, we've got an amazing malt plant that does a lot with craft breweries called Great Western Malting. And that's where we get 90%
of... That's who we use for 90% of our malt. And
yeah.
It's fabulous.
So the majority of malted barley that they're producing around here that gets malted here is going to be what's considered base malt. That's where the majority of your sugar content comes from when you're making a beer. So when you look at different areas around the world, there's these areas that people associate with being these like beer ingredient meccas. You look at like the Hallertau in Germany for hop production, or you look at the Yakima Valley in Washington. And really right here, that's where we are with barley. The majority of malted barley that's going into beer in the United States is produced right here in Southern Idaho.
So why Southern Idaho? Why are we so good at barley?
I think that we have really good soil, for mm-hmm. one. We've got
the soil is very important. That's pretty much why they are able to grow it here.
For sure. We've got a lot of great mineral content in our soil, I think, from the past volcanic activity. And then also the Snake River. The Snake River is just such a huge source for irrigation. And we have a lot of really low humidity days, too, in the summer. So we can produce some really great barley, but not just that, really high yields.
High yields, yeah. They produce like, I don't know, almost double
Montana.
Yeah,
so sometimes we'll produce, another state might actually produce more barley than us, but our yields are so high that we end up receiving more finished product by like twofold than other states.
Right, yeah. So your per acre yield is higher than
Correct.
Other states.
Yes, yeah.
So how about hops production here?
Hops production has grown drastically since 2015. So we're second in the nation for hop production, right behind Washington, surpassed Oregon a few years ago. So it's a $90 million a year industry for Idaho. It's like top eight farm commodities now. In 2015, it was like a $31 million a year industry, and it's grown that much. So hops in Idaho are becoming very popular. We also just recently, I don't know, maybe 5 years ago.
It was right before we opened.
Yeah, I think it was 5 years ago. Mill 95 out of Parma, Idaho opened, which they are a hop processing plant. And I think with that processing plant, it really increased the hop farmers' ability to get their hops processed. Because you can use a lot of different styles of hop. You can use whole cone hop. You can use leaf. You can,
yeah.
There's pellets. There's oils. There's.
But all hops, when they come off the vine, they need to be processed and put in some sort of stable environment
Correct.
So that brewers can use them. They need to be packaged up.
Packaged
right?
properly. Typically, and, like nitrogen.
Yeah, nitrogen flushing the bags, all this kind of stuff. But before Mill 95, so I think that was 2000.
I think it was 2017. I'm not 100% sure. But.
Before then, all the hops that were produced in Idaho had to be sent out of state to get processed.
Which is really expensive for the hop farmers. And so having that centralized processing facility, it's pretty much in between all of the different hop farms, super helpful. And now they're just producing a lot of hops. So.
And the majority of those hops are produced in southwest Idaho, more near
Parma, Boise.
Parma. Southwest of Boise.
So when we look at a hoppy beer, there's all kinds of different flavors associated with hops. And I assume that during the brewing process, you can kind of determine the types of flavors you have with the hops. Are there also different hybrids or other subspecies of hops that we grow? Or are we looking at just one type of hop plant
that's
typically grown?
There's a ton of different hop varietals now. So they're always trying to breed new types of hops that, for one, have better agronomics. That's the number one goal, right? But also are producing new flavors in beer.
Mm-hmm.
So there's basically two uses of hops in beer. One of them is adding it for bittering. And then number two is adding aroma to the beer. So before this big IPA craze, most of the hops that people were producing were just going in as bittering. Now you're putting in hops in all of these different times of the beer that was considered sacrilege before.
Yeah.
And we're getting a lot of different essential oils that are coming out of the hops that taste like mango and guava and
pineapple.
Yeah, lots of different things.
Passion fruit and all of these super tropical fruits that you would never really associate with hops prior. And that's why a lot of, when we first opened our brewery, Davis and I love all ingredients of beer, obviously, but we really enjoy the hop aspect because there's so many different flavors that you can get out of a beer. And when we first opened, everyone was like, I don't want an IPA. I don't like IPAs. They're horrible. They're bitter. They burn my mouth, taste buds off. And, you know, we were like, oh, well, we make very different IPAs. We make IPAs that you eventually start to crave because there's not that bitter blast of intensity when you're drinking it. There's a little bit of bitterness, but it's nicely balanced with the malt sweetness, and you get a lot of the hop oils of the citrus and the fruits instead of the bitterness. That's kind of the new trend of IPAs.
I can remember many years back when I was first trying out my first IPAs and hoppy beer, and you would run across one and like, oh, you know, it would just almost knock you on your on the ground because it was so bitter.
Yeah.
And then others would be very, very mild and you lose the flavor or there would be a super bitter aftertaste as well. So, you know, I really do appreciate, in a sense, the modern use of hops now.
I do too. I'm right there with you. I was never a IPA person, really. Back when they were super bitter bombs, I was like, I don't know about these. Like, I'll drink one, but I'm not, you know, kind of want to switch it up. But now I really appreciate hops and what they have to offer. And Fly Hopper is one of our biggest selling beers, which is hilarious to me because the people that first came in were like, never will I drink an IPA, and that's all they drink now. So
yeah, it's pretty wild. Everybody told us we couldn't sell IPAs in Pocatello, so you just had to have the right ones.
That's funny. Well, that's great. And, and so it's a palette that you get to work with, and finding the nuances in the ingredients is like a lot of the fun of putting together your own brews, right?
Yeah, for sure. It's almost like being a chef mixed with like an artist mixed with being a scientist. So it's pretty much the best of all worlds, really.
Sounds fun. So there are brew fests. I wanted to talk about some of the brew fests that are happening in our part of Idaho. Can you tell us a little bit about the Idaho Falls Brew Fest?
Yeah, so Mountain Brewers Brew Fest is in Idaho Falls. It's the first weekend in June. And the nice thing about that Brew Fest is it's in conjunction with the North American Beer Awards. So it's one of the largest beer competitions in the United States. So it draws in breweries from all around the U.S. that you would never get in this market. So you get these breweries that don't distribute, that you'd basically not be able to try, all in one location up at Sandy Downs. And it's just a great place to really go through and kind of attune to what kind of beer, figure out what kind of beer you like, and see what kind of beers out there that you've never tried before, as well as trying beers that just won international awards.
Yeah, it's a great brew fest for sure. And all of the proceeds go towards local charities. So that's also really awesome.
Yeah, they've raised millions of dollars for local charities, so it's really a great event.
And then we have a local brew fest, the Gate City Brew Fest, which is also awesome.
That one just passed. It's in the beginning of March, usually.
Yeah, that one, you kind of go around to all the locations, you walk around, so it's a much different setup than a typical brew fest, which makes it kind of fun, too, because it's so different. But yeah, lots of local breweries, regional breweries, Utah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, fun.
That's great. And it gives people a chance to sample things that maybe they, you know, they can't find at the grocery store or something like that.
For sure.
Yeah.
And get, again, sampling the nuances and flavors that different chefs are putting together. Right?
Yep, exactly.
So you started this story back at, you know, being a home brewer. And then you've scaled up, and now you know it's a commercial enterprise for you, which kind of maybe shifts not only the volume that you're dealing with, but now it's a business, and you have to think about the economics of it. But take us back to homebrew and how people can get engaged and dip their toe into the waters of homebrewing.
Yeah, I think the easiest place to start for homebrew is to get an extract kit. So instead of using actual malted barley, they're going to extract all the sugar out of that and put it in this basically like syrup.
Yeah, it's just like a liquid form of your malted barley.
Yeah, okay. So you're just going to take that and you're going to mix it in with water. I believe it's been so long since we've done it.
I mean, it's a step-by-step instructional kit, and they tell you, okay, put this in with some water, boil it, add your hops at these certain times, and then put it into your sanitized fermenter, which is typically like a glass or plastic carboy, and then you just let it sit with an airlock on it and get to watch it bubble, and it's fun. And then you can put it into your secondary if you want, and then you let it naturally carbonate in bottles. Typically is how you would start out.
That's the simplest way to do it.
Yeah.
There's even Mr. Beer kits. That's what a lot of people start as.
Yeah, you like
really,
press a button.
Really inexpensive.
And it just
beer different options.
There's some
out there
crazy
right
options now.
Is it like buying a frozen pizza,
yeah.
put it in the oven, and hit 425
yeah.
degrees?
Exactly. Yeah.
Depending on how much you
crazy.
Want to spend, there basically is now. They have ones that are almost like the espresso machine, you know, where you just press a button and it comes out. Although you press the button and it takes like 3 weeks to come out.
So. Yeah. Gotcha.
So it just depends on how in depth you want to take it. But yeah, starting out in an extract kit is probably the best option just so you don't get too, you know.
Too many variables.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if something doesn't turn out great doing it the other way, you might get a little discouraged. So I always say start at the easiest point and then work your way up.
Yeah. I was going to say too, you don't always brew winners.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
It's okay to. Yeah. Dump that down the drain because it just isn't quite palatable.
It's a bit of a science experiment, you know?
Totally.
Especially those first ones, you're like, oh, this is going to taste great. And then you walk in and open up the room it's fermenting in and it smells like rotten eggs or something. You're like, okay.
Yeah, there was a couple times in our apartment in Bozeman, we're like, I don't know. But, and that's all part of learning, right? You have to start at those points to learn, hey, this is something in the future. We got to change this. We got to change that. Oh, I used ingredients that didn't necessarily mesh together very well, right? Now I know what this type of malted barley tastes like versus this type of malted barley, which ones will go together well.
Yeah, I think it's best to just start at a small batch size, something that you're not going to be too disappointed to dump down the drain if you need to. And then also that if it's great and you drink it, then you can get back to it and brew another one that's even better the next time.
Yeah, and then maybe you'll get to the point where you're like, all of these are tasting delicious, and we should
let's open up a brewery.
And then you get to learn it all over again because it's so different from homebrewing. But it is good to have homebrewing skills for sure.
So I got to ask before trivia, do you have a beer that's your favorite to brew?
Ooh,
That's a great question. I really like to brew the IPAs because we add a lot of different hops at different points.
Yes.
That's super fun.
I really also, recently we just started brewing sours, which is we do kettle sours, and that's where you add the lactobacillus to the kettle instead of to the fermenter. And that way you just make sure that you're not cross-contaminating anything. And that's a lot of fun. I've really enjoyed using lactobacillus.
But as far as the brew day goes, the best beer to brew is definitely an imperial stout because it smells amazing in the brewery. It smells like you're making some
chocolate cake
confection.
Yeah.
It's so good.
Yeah, imperial stouts are pretty amazing. Actually, any stout is
stouts are really
so
good to brew.
Yeah,
they just smell great.
But yeah,
they taste great too.
They do. We love stouts. I don't know if you've guys tried the babushka.
Yes.
You have.
Yes.
Yeah.
Russian imperial stout.
We'll have to bring you.
It's, it's good. You only get a small glass because you don't want a big one.
You could try it.
That's funny. We started off this program with a trivia question, which is the most mathematical question we've had yet. It's kind of a satisfying answer, so bear with me here. Idaho produces around 55 million bushels of barley per year, and 75% of that goes to produce beer. So the question is, how many 12-ounce beers does that produce? And the answer is?
4.1 billion 12-ounce beers.
That's it. Lot of beer produced. Yes.
Billion with a B.
Idaho barley.
Yes. We should be proud.
1 billion with
billion.
A B.
Yes.
Yeah, so you're more than likely, if you're picking up a beer basically anywhere in the United States, there is a large percentage chance that you're having Idaho barley in that beer.
Yep.
That's amazing.
We've got a national Idaho connection off of this barley.
So
you can
important.
Enjoy that with a russet.
Totally.
Yeah.
Potato.
Even
and
in
maybe
Mexico.
Some lentils, too.
So, lentils are a big one.
Yeah, lentils.
Yeah, the Modelo malt plant in Idaho Falls, actually, all of that, they malt it here and they send it down to Mexico.
Yeah,
it's
so
probably
maybe
the
even
same
some,
down
you know,
there.
I mean, everyone enjoys the Modelo.
Yeah. It's Modelo time.
This has
time.
Been great, guys. And thank you, Davis and Haley, for joining us. And, I mean, honestly, for more information about Jim Dandy Brewing, just go to jimdandybrewing.com.
Check us out on our website and on social media. We're on Instagram and Facebook, too. So, yeah, we'd love to see you. Thank you guys so much. We love being here.
The Nature of Idaho is recorded at the KISU studios on the ISU campus in Pocatello. Production is by Avery Frazier and Jamin Anderson. Send feedback to noidkisu@isu.edu. Weekly episodes can be found at kisu.org or wherever you get your podcasts.